the next speaker, who I have a very long history with, and I can't get into all the details, but I can tell you that throughout my entire time at Lincoln Square, when Ray Kenneth Brander was the assistant rabbi at the Lincoln Square Synagogue when I first met him. Actually, I met him before when he was in yeshiva, and he was head of the leadership seminars and other things. But throughout the time that I was his youth director, working directly under him at Lincoln Square, the Rav was on his was always there. He was always talking about the Rav, sharing the Torah of the Rav. And he gave us tremendous stories all the time. I remember them to this day. And of course, Rabbi Brander moved on to from Lincoln Square Synagogue assistant rabbi to becoming the rabbi in Boca Raton, to becoming the senior vice president of University, the Center for Jewish Future, and now is the president at Rosh Hashiva of Or Torah Stone. And it is my great honor to ask Rabbi Brander to speak about his connection with the Rav.
It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here. Brishut the Rav. I must tell you, it's always a little daunting to speak about Rabbi Soloveitchik. But to speak about Rabbi Soloveitchik in front of a grandchild is even more daunting and challenging, only to know how much he loved his grandchildren and would speak about his grandchildren, and they would rotate to spend time with Rabbi Soloveitchik. He was a doting grandfather. As much as he was a Gadol Hador, he was a doting grandfather. I want to thank Zeb Berman for sponsoring this, and I think it would be inappropriate not to mention, should live and be well, Rabbi Julie Berman. You know, many people call themselves students of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'm not sure Rabbi Soloveitchik called them all his students. But one of them that was definitely his student, and please God should live and be well, was Rabbi Julie Berman. And those of us who had the privilege of living with Rabbi Soloveitchik for a limited period of time, we were able to hang out in the apartment and see much. But when he had private meetings with Julie Berman, it was understood that we were not welcomed. But it just speaks to that relationship. And if I could just make one comment on what Rabbi Bravender said about Rabbi Soloveitchik not having an outline, I think that was true for his Talmud classes, but in my time, I could speak loud. I'll just speak louder. In my time, Rabbi Soloveitchik gave also a Chumash class, and he would ask me to write out his thoughts. There were no computers, just on a piece of paper, but in writing that was legible and he could read. And the interesting thing was, I don't remember the percentages, but a large percentage of the time, and this speaks to Rabbi Bravender's point, the notes that Rabbi Soloveitchik prepared in the apartment for the Chumash class that he was giving in 501 was a different class than he presented. In other words, we would sit an hour before the class. He would dictate what he wanted us to write. And then those notes were in front of him, and he would give a totally different class. Mamish, totally different. It was the best thing for me because I heard two classes that night instead of one. But it was a totally, totally different class. Again, not consistently like that, and there was always some connections, but I don't remember, again, it was a very long time ago, but I don't remember there being so many times that what we wrote down, what I just heard from him and he was asked to write down, is what he presented literally 20 minutes later in 501. When people describe Rabbi Soloveitchik, they refer to his brilliance, whether it's when he was 10 years old, he presented to his father some of his Chidushei Torah that Rav Chaim saw. It's evident that all people have written about Rabbi Soloveitchik, or the note that Rav Chaim wrote in the Rambam that he gave the Rav for his bar mitzvah, or the smicha that he got from the Rav of Kovno, which speaks about how great it will be for the country that has the privilege to be the home of this great sage. Rabbi Soloveitchik is a true interpreter of halacha, and halacha is kamoto, is like him in all areas of halacha. Or the letter that his father wrote when the Rav was a candidate for the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Or the comments of Rav Kook, the power of the genius of the grandfather resides in the grandson. The comments in conversations that the Rav had with Rav Moshe Feinstein, or Rav Huttner, or the Rebbe of Lubavitch, or at that time, Rav Rudiman, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael. And even though they may have disagreed on certain issues, they all respected each other. And I don't think there's any family since Rashi in the 11th and 12th centuries that can boast of as many influential Torah scholars as the Soloveitchik family. Not only in the past, the Beis Halevi, the Netziv, Rav Chaim of Elazhin, and the Rav was a true student of the Soloveitchik family of Masorah, but also Baruch Hashem of the present and please God in the future. He learned from his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and he learned from his mother, Pesha Feinstein. The Rav was at home in any sugya of Shas, in any halachic ideal, and in any philosophic argument. He used his knowledge to introduce us to the full spectrum of Torah thought. I remember while Rabbi Bravender was speaking that we were learning Shabbos and we were speaking about Hotzah being a Malacha Gerua, and all of a sudden Rabbi Soloveitchik started discussing the philosophy of communism, how those who were responsible for transportation from one location to another location weren't part of a union, because a union had to produce something and they just moved goods from one place to another place. And he explained that's what Tosos means of a Malacha Gerua. In every shir, another color woven into the tapestry of the Masorah that he wished to communicate to his students. His clarity, his charisma, his excitement, the intellectual integrity made his daily shiurim exciting and attracted many different types of thinkers and scholars. Young smicha students and veteran Rashi Yeshiva hung to every word he spoke. He once made a comment that he would never teach the same masechta as the rest of the yeshiva, because many of the Rosh Yeshiva would come and hear his shir, and he wanted them to have to prepare their own shir. The Talmudic scholars came from every yeshiva. You would be able to see the color of the room changed right before, like Pesach and Sukkot, because YU ended not Chodesh Nisan, but like a few days before Pesach. So all of a sudden, in those days, most of the guys wore kippot strugot. So all of a sudden, you would see that the shir room 401 had many more hats than it did. You know, to the best of my recollection, the only one who walked with a hat into shir was Rabbi Blau. But the bottom line is, like, no one did. But like 2 weeks into Chodesh Nisan or right before Sukkot, the place was filled with hats because everybody came from everywhere just to hear Rabbi Soloveitchik. And while his philosophy of Judaism, as Rabbi Bravender mentioned, and especially in halachic mind, was often articulated through the ideals of Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard, and Cohen, it was always predicated on the ideals of the Rambam. There is no Jewish community in the world that has not been touched by the Rav, his students, or his writings. Now, I don't have the knowledge or the capacity to expound on the Rav's greatness and learning, but here are a few observations that I would like to share. In the Rav shir, a student's age, their experience, their family name were all but irrelevant. All that counted was the truth. At times, the Rav would dismiss a veteran Torah scholar's thesis in favor of a young student's suggestion. Now, Rabbi Bravender was B-R-O. I was B-R-A. But for reasons I didn't deserve, I actually sat next to the Rav, and I was in charge of making sure that he knew where he ended off on the sheet so the BRAs didn't get called every single day. And so one day, and I'm not going to mention the person's name because he's a pretty famous rabbi right now, he called on someone in Shir, and the guy would not even slowly, he was not going to read. So the guy goes, the Rav yells out, whatever, let's just say, Brander, Brander, read. And this guy is like scared, and he announces, Brander's not here. So the Rav goes, okay, you read. And I'll never forget the time that the Rav responded to several questions after Shir. Didn't always think that was fair, because sometimes the Rav Shir was 2.5 hours long. People would ask him questions, and the Rav answered every question. And then at one point he said to me, could you call that boy back who just asked the question? And the Rav said to him, you were right. He asked him a question on Shir. I wasn't listening, so I don't know what he asked him. You were right, and I was wrong. Tomorrow we're going to restudy the sugya based on the question you raised. In the Rav's apartment, he would get a lot of mail. The mail he got from Yeshiva University never said Rabbi Soloveitchik. It always said Dr. Soloveitchik. I never understood that, but okay. Even the mail from Reitz said Dr. Joseph Soloveitchik. But he used to get all this mail, and we would have the privilege of just sitting and reading the mail for Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he would tell us very clearly what he wanted, if any response, what he wanted the response to be. And it was word for word. We obviously would never do anything other than that. But one time, we were walking in the evening, and I asked him, Rebbe, you get all of this mail. And like sometimes the envelope, like it had like the grand rabbi of whatever, chief rabbi of what, like the envelope was like, was longer than the letter, the introduction. And so I said, Rebbe, what introduction do you prefer? And he said, I just want to be known as Malamed. I just want to be known as a teacher. And when the Rav presented an argument between various schools of thought in the Gemara or among Rishonim, you felt as if the personalities that were being discussed were present in the room. It was in the Rav Shir room that many of us felt that we met Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam, the Rashba, the Rif, the Ravid, and the Ramban. And of course, we became closely acquainted with the personality, language, and demeanor of the Ravs, and I would never use these words in front of him. I didn't know these words at that time. The Ravs BFF, his best friend forever, the Ramba. One time, we were informed, different members of Rabbi Soloveitchik's immediate family had different responsibilities, but the ones who lived in America were especially Rabbi Santorsky, a blessed memory, was in charge of health issues. 617-232-7356. I still remember her phone number. I was so intimidated. And she called us and she said, my father cannot give shir for more than 2 hours. And on the first day that we were informed about this, we just reminded Rebbe, 2 hours, of course, of course. And I drew clocks, like a 1 o'clock clock, a 1:30 clock, and a 2 o'clock clock. Because I sat, Rabbi Soloveitchik would say was sitting here. I was like sitting here. And like an hour into the shir, I just like moved over the 1 o'clock thing. An hour and a half into the shir, the 1:30. And 2 hours in, the 2. And the first day, it like worked like a charm. And Rabbi Soloveitchik stopped at 2 hours into the shir. Everybody in the shir was like shocked that Rabbi Soloveitchik stopped. The next day, however, didn't work so well. After passing the Rav the note of 2 hours, he continued to teach. I found myself in a quandary. I'm, 21, something like that at that point. How does a 21-year-old respond when the Gadol Hador is not following his medically prescribed limitations? And suffice it to say that all eyes were curious on how this dilemma would unfold. So around 45 minutes after the 2 hours, I got up and I went over to the Gemara. I closed the Gemara and I said, "Shir is over." At which point Rabbi Soloveitchik turns to me without missing a beat. I can still hear the words. "Even the Satan does not have as good as an assistant as I do." And shir was over, and everyone laughed for a lot longer. And normally when the Rav walked back to his apartment in Morgenstern Hall, there were a lot of people that would walk back with the Rav. No one wanted to be there for this. So we walked back to the apartment, and it was a very quiet lunch. And the Rav asked me what was wrong, and I explained to him I wasn't doing this because of me. I was doing this, I was following the instructions. And the Rav responded, he goes, "You should know better than anyone else that before I give shir in the morning, I often am in pain. And in the afternoons after shir, I am often in pain. But when I'm delivering shir to my students, which could be his grandchildren, he was pain-free." And how correct he was. During my years that I had this privilege of being somewhat informally connected with the Rav, the mornings and afternoons were often difficult, but during shir, the Rav was vibrant, enthused, and pain-free. He would often walk into shir with blurry sight, yet he still was able to read the Gemara, the Rambam, and Rashi as if his sight was unimpaired. And the next day in shir, I had decided, I'm not stopping the Rav after 2 hours. I'm done. However, after an hour and a half, the Rav turned to me in shir and goes, "How much time do I have left?" That was the last time that happened also, but okay. The Rav had a reputation of being tough in shir. Really not that much in my time. I was towards the final years that Rabbi Soloveitchik was in NYU. But his demands he made of his Talmidim were out of love for them and a commitment to being the best possible Malamed, or as Rabbi Bravender said, Chavruta. He taught us that Judaism is not a religion of simplicity, but one of nuance, that halacha must be our northern star, that all forms of knowledge are sacred, and that general knowledge can color, enhance our understanding of Torah, and while at the same time academic studies are important, they need to be framed through the prism of Torah values. I never remember, I just could be wrong, I never remember seeing or the Rav using the term Torah and Mada. But he believed that all knowledge was a beautiful and complicated tapestry with an inherent tension in its weave. But outside of shir, his demeanor was welcoming, gentle, and kind. He had not only inherited, and I think this is a really important point, because I can't speak about the Rav as a great Talmud Chacham, that's obvious, but I don't have the capacity to explain that. But he not only inherited Rav Chaim's intellect, he internalized Rav Chaim's ideals of chesed. And allow me to explain this, because Rabbi Soloveitchik would talk about this at times. Rav Chaim was the Rav in Brisk, he lived from 1853 to 1918. Rav Chaim is credited as the one who formalized the way we approach Talmud in modern times, a method of highly exacting and analytical Talmudical study. He focused on precise definitions and categorizations of Jewish law, and it's used, Rav Chaim's Shita is used in almost every single yeshiva, particular an emphasis on the legal writings of Maimonides. He spent many years in the yeshiva of Volozhin, but he was the Rav in Brisk. And I remembered one day that someone brought, this was again still in the times of communism, so people didn't travel as much to certain areas, that someone brought a picture of the Matseva of Rav Chaim to the Rav. He's buried in Warsaw. There's a whole story behind that also, but this is not the time to discuss that. And when the Rav saw the pictures of this, he shared with everybody who was in the apartment that while Rav Chaim was known for redefining Talmud study, he was also known as a Rav Chesed. And I remember him saying to us, that's why on the Matseva of Rav Chaim, doesn't speak about his, I'm a Kohen, so I haven't really seen the Matseva. It doesn't really speak about Rav Chaim's redoing his knowledge of all of Shas and stuff. It speaks about him being the Av Beis Din DeBrisk. Now, many years ago, I led a group on the March of the Living, and I told the story about Rav Chaim. Is how you're going to teach public school kids as well as ninth graders, 10th graders about who Rav Chaim is. And I explained to him about him being a Rav Chesed. And obviously they felt that my presentation was moving enough. They did something that I wish I would have known beforehand. But when they came back, they took a tracing of the kever. They put a piece of paper on the kever and they did a tracing because they knew I would never see it. And they gave it to me with a beautiful inscription. But the piece that I think is important here is Av Beis Din DeBrisk Talita. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik would speak about the fact that his grandfather understood what it means to be a Rav. It's not just about the drasha, but it's about the unmarried woman who gives birth and who deals with that baby. It's about the woodshed and brisk that would not just heat the home of the rabbi, but he only was willing to use the woodshed on the condition that it didn't have a padlock so anyone could use it. And when there was a fire in the town and the poorer people's homes were not being rebuilt, Rav Chaim slept on the burnt out porches until they rebuilt those homes. That was Rabbi Soloveitchik. People would leave the Rav's apartment with a sense of comfort, either because the Rav had a solution to their problems or simply because he listened so intently. When the Rav heard a fellow human being's problems, be it Menachem Begin or a simple Jew sent by his or her rabbi, the Rav was so empathetic, you could actually see the pain and anguish on his face and his frail body. It would be harder for him to walk, harder for him to sleep, and harder for him to eat. He was an Ish Chesed who truly felt the pain of others, happy when he could halachically solve their dilemma, pained when he could not, and sleepless and steadfast when he had the opportunity to marshal his halachic arsenal to help another human being. There was more than one time. There was only one bedroom in the Rav's apartment. So I slept in a suit next to Rabbi Soloveitchik for a few years. Eventually moved to sweats and a t-shirt. But the bottom line is, I remember several times that at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, it wasn't easy for Rabbi Soloveitchik always to move around. I remember waking up and seeing that Rabbi Soloveitchik was sitting in the parlor room, just like thinking about an appointment that he knew he had the next day of how he would be able to solve the problem. And this was not only with Jews, but even the Irish woman who cleaned the apartment, Mrs. O'Shea. He knew her family. And he would ask how she was doing. I mean, he knew the children. Meetings with people never became routine for Rabbi Soloveitchik. And if there's anything I learned, it's that message. never smugness, and never a laissez-faire attitude. He had a special camaraderie with Rav Moshe Feinstein, with Rav Ruderman and Lubav Babaji Rebbe, and every time a new sefer or pamphlet came out from Chabad, the Rebbe would send two shlichim to the apartment. Many, if not all, were inscribed with a lovely note to Rabbi Soloveitchik from the Rebbe. In Chaslovich, Rabbi Soloveitchik started out with a mechanech, Baruch Riesberg, and it was Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother who realized that Rabbi Soloveitchik with this melamed wasn't really learning Gemara. And Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother told Rav Moshe Soloveitchik that Beryl, which was the name that they used, Beryl isn't learning so well. He didn't take her perspective so seriously, so she spoke to Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather, Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim gave him a bechina at some point, and he didn't know the Gemara. And then he asked him, what are you learning with this melamed? At which point Rabbi Soloveitchik was able to recite all of Tanya. It turns out, I heard the story through Rabbi Soloveitchik's. It turns out that they had a big Gemara. They would pass by the classroom. They would see the Gemara's open. But what they never checked was that in the Gemara there was a smaller Tanya. And when he was never learning with this melamed the Gemara, he was always learning with this melamed Tanya. Well, there's a good thing and a bad thing to it. The good thing is, or maybe they're both good, the good thing is that if you read any of the Rav's writings, whether it's Ubikashta Misham, you will see how influenced he was by the Tanya and how much he was able to quote from the Tanya. I remember once he told Lubavitcher Rebbe, I know the Tanya as well as the Hasidim, even though you might suggest I'm not a Hasid. But the bottom line is, and at the same time, then he started to learn just with one person, or actually both, his mother and his father, but particularly with his father. Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Ruderman and Rav Moshe would speak to each other before every single chag. We had like a list of phone numbers on a sheet of paper. And it was sometimes our responsibility to call those people. So Rabbi Soloveitchik would just wish them a chag, and wish them a good nyantif. Never could understand those conversations because they were in Yiddish. Rabbi, we got married, my wife and I got married in September of 1985. We had the privilege of Rabbi Soloveitchik being at our wedding. And the Rav then moved Shir from being in First Hall, then being next door to his apartment. And then around Pesach time, he stopped coming to YU. On Tainus Esther 1986, Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away. The Rav was not feeling well. His family asked us that we not inform Rabbi Soloveitchik of the patira of his friend. Obviously, we would do whatever the family asked us to do. So the next morning, the New York Times that normally came to the apartment didn't show up. There was a radio right next to where the Rav sat, where the 1010 Winds News would sometimes play. The apartment, the radio didn't work. And I was then in Rav Schechter's Kollel, and I never drove the Rav either from the airport or to the airport. There were, I guess, designated drivers for that. But the week prior to Pesach, because why you went into right before the Pesach, the Rav had someone call the Kollel, there was the Kollel on the third floor, First Hall. He had someone call the outside, there was a payphone, and asked that if I could drive Rabbi Soloveitchik to the airport. Obviously, we drove him to the airport. And as we're driving down the Grand Central Parkway to the Eastern Airlines shuttle, the Rav asked me why I didn't inform him that Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away. My response, first of all, I wanted to continue driving. It's the Grand Central Parkway. My response was one of total silence. And after several tense moments, I simply explained to him that this was done at the request of the family out of concern for his health. But then I then turned to him and asked, Rebbe, how did you find out? And his response was the following. Every yontif, either I call Rav Moshe finds Rav Moshe or he calls me. This Pesach, it was his turn to call me, and there can only be one reason that he didn't call. That was his response. He treated some of us like adopted grandchildren. He would sometimes quiz us if we were going for master's degrees. He knew Hebrew literature by heart, so when I was doing a paper on Hebrew literature and he asked to look at the paper, he made some comments, which I put in a footnote. Rabbi Soloveitchik commented on this and this and this. I got an A, but the teacher never gave me back the paper because of that footnote. When my wife and I got engaged, and it had to be on a Monday night, because by Tuesday night, Rabbi Soloveitchik was already in the apartment, I brought her to the Rav's apartment. It was not easy for Rabbi Soloveitchik to get up and walk to the door and open the door, but when he heard that my challah was by the door, he insisted on getting up, walking to the door, opening the door, waiting till she sat down before he sat down. And when we asked him if he would come to the wedding, he said, if he's invited, he will try to come. Rabbi Soloveitchik paid a price for many of the things he did. His departure on the issues of his attitudes towards Zionism in the State of Israel. We know that in the early 1940s, the Rebbe shifted his allegiance from Agudas Yisrael to Mizrahi. And by the mid-1950s, he emerged as one of the most important spokespeople for the State of Israel. And sometimes the government would ask him to intercede with other faith leaders on behalf of the fledgling state's behalf, and he would do so without hesitation. But even when he took up this mantle, because he was so committed to his family's Mesorah, he would sometimes discuss the fact that he was charting a different course from that of his family and his teachers. And I remember, because sometimes there was a more informal environment in the apartment, a playful conversation that he retold between him and the Prime Minister, Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin's family came from the city of Bris. The Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim, was the city rabbi, and Begin's father, Wolf Dov, was the gabbai of the city's main synagogue. They had different perspectives on Zionism. And Wolf Dov Begin arranged that in the shul of Rav Chaim, a eulogy would be given, I believe, to Theodor Herzl. The Prime Minister pointed out to the Rav the irony that Rav Chaim's grandson became the preeminent spokesman for religious Zionism in the diaspora. At which point, Rabbi Soloveitchik, without missing a beat, said, and just remember that after your father did that, my grandfather took away the keys of the shul from him. The same educational integrity that motivated the Rav's view that girls and women should be afforded opportunities to study Torah, including the Talmud. You can just read some of the letters of the Rav. Despite long record of rabbinic opposition, the Rav, at a price, he and his wife, when they established Maimonides, insisted that both male and female students have the opportunity to discuss study Talmud. It was inconceivable for him that women should be encouraged to achieve the highest level of scholarship without being able to study Talmud. And in 1977, the Rav gave the famous Talmud shiur at Stern College, and he related to me that he gave the lecture to ensure that no one could claim that the Talmud that was taught at Stern College was without his approval. He wanted the initiative to have his public sign and emphasize the importance he ascribed to Torah and Talmud study to women. And if you look at Torah and Talmud study for women 45 years later, you will notice that the foremost institutions that teach Torah to women are all students of Rabbi Soloveitchik, whether it's Migdal Oz, or whether it's the holy work that Rabbi Bravender started, or whether the work of Nishmat or others. They're all students or descendants of Rabbi Soloveitchik. His commitment to the project has yielded very significant dividends. But sometimes those two stands caused him isolating consequences, which I don't feel comfortable sharing, but they did cause him isolating consequences. But he had a vision, and he wanted that vision to be one that he was willing to sacrifice for. So while he was first and foremost and always a Malamed, he also had a vision for the Jewish community. So I'd like to conclude with an idea that was communicated by his brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal, at the Rav's funeral. Rav Aaron said that when the base of Mikdash was burning, the Pirchei Kehuna went to the rooftop and surrendered the keys by throwing them up to Shemayim. Rav Aaron explained that this was an act not of greatness, but of Chorban. That even when the Beis HaMikdash was burning, no one had the right to surrender the keys. It was that surrender which doomed the Jewish people to a long and difficult gullus. Over the past 30 years, many have had the schus of being students of the Rav, or the students of some of the Rav's senior Talmidim. But I believe that for us as a community, he defined our mission and public posture. Not that modernity shapes halacha, but halacha shapes modernity. His passing is not a time to surrender or abandon his calling, but to recommit to his vision as both students and teachers of his tradition. And I believe, again, that we have to embrace Torah, not shaped by modernity, but a modernity that has to be shaped by Torah. So may HaKadosh Baruch Hu give all of us, each in our own very limited way, the capacity to move from being students of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Mesorah to sometimes chavrusas of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Mesorah. And may we continue his legacy in respectful and appropriate ways. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Thank you very much.
Again, I want to thank the Yeshiva University of Israel and Stephanie Strauss, the Vice President in Israel. I think that's your title.